All right, well, we're continuing in our topical series, and in response to, I had a number of folk approach me on Sunday after the message, so I thought I would expand a little bit on that Egyptian chronology, as well as add to it another side of the whole picture, and that is the promised land. You know, you've got the incidents that happened after the Exodus as well, which is an important part. It comes along into the whole picture. Because you've got these two geographical areas that were impacted by the Exodus. Obviously Egypt and the build-up to the Exodus and the Exodus itself. And then you've got the promised land that was impacted by the nation of Israel moving into that part of the world. And then you'd expect to see something in both places. Both incidents were pretty sizable. Incidents were taking place of turmoil and upheaval. But the traditional dating, both in Egypt and the archaeology in the Promised Land, they do not support what Scripture says happened at that time. So there's nothing that matches up in the archaeological records, the archaeological digs, as far as the dating of those periods go. Obviously the evidence is there, but the dating is all wrong. So the chronology of Egypt has troubled scholars for a long time. And at the end of the 1800s, George Rawlings, in his two-volume work entitled A History of Egypt, said, "It is a patent fact, and one that is beginning to obtain general recognition, that the chronological elements in early Egyptian history is in a state of almost hopeless obscurity. The Egyptian had no era. They drew out no chronological schemes and omitted to distinguish the sole reign of a monarch from his joint reign with others." That's in his volume two. Beginning of that volume. Yet despite this, the traditional Egyptian chronology is regarded as a standard by which the Bible is to be evaluated. Thus, when it is presumed that the traditional Egyptian chronology is correct, one has to give up trying to reconcile the Bible with it. And so you have John Durham in his Word Biblical Commentary. Now, this is one of the recognized standard scholarly works of our day that many people would refer to. He says in there, "The determination of any exact historical context for events mentioned in the book of Exodus thus remains impossible." Remains impossible. We cannot find any connection. "Or one has to look upon the biblical account of things as being imprecise and vague, as Alan Cole does in his commentary on Exodus in the conservative Tyndale commentary series. Cole says, it is usually considered nowadays that the Exodus took place in the early years of the 19th dynasty, 1310 to 1200. In either case, this is the simple language of popular folk history, expressing a truth but not concerned with exact dates." So don't worry about this thing, it's not touching. Just realize that this is just a vague thing that the Bible is giving us. Scholars who didn't agree with such suggestions that the Bible was unconcerned with the exact dates rejected the 19th dynasty because it contradicted 1 Kings 6, 1 by some 200 years. Because of the 480 years that is mentioned there from the Exodus to the beginning of Solomon's temple being built. And so with that worked out, it brought the dates from 1300 and something to 1450, there, around about there. And the traditional Egyptian chronology had this date in the 18th dynasty. So what you've got are dates. So we've got a true date now. We've got 1450s as the time of the Exodus. But you've got these dynasties that have been assigned dates by your investigators, by your historians, and they've assigned different dates to different dynasties. And so once you've got a date, you just look down and say, okay, it means this dynasty. So it plopped the conservative Christians into the 18th dynasty where the Exodus took place. But there are serious problems with placing the Exodus there. There was no kings in the dynasty which were called Ramesses, as Exodus 1:15 talks about the slaves built supply cities, one of which was called Ramesses. The kings of the 18th dynasty ruled from Thebes or Thebes, which is a city that is way south from the Delta area where the Jews were placed. And it would be improbable that you would have people ruling from that distance when the focus was around the Delta area at the time of the build-up to the Exodus, where the slaves were dwelling. The nominated pharaoh of the Exodus from this dynasty exists in mummy form, thus contradicting Psalm 136:15. And furthermore, there's nothing in an Egyptian inscription from the 18th dynasty that suggests there was any significant crisis in Egypt at this time. And moreover, the power of the and the prosperity from those pharaohs they say were in existence for the build-up to the Exodus and then the Exodus itself, the actual prosperity and power of that pharaoh extended in the widest expanse of Egyptian history. So the pharaoh in the build-up to the Exodus had the most power and extensive reign than any Egyptian pharaoh had. And the one who succeeded him, i.e. the Exodus pharaoh, there was no change in his power and his influence and his reign. So you're saying, okay, this doesn't square up with what happened the Exodus. Thutmose III is said to be the oppressing pharaoh, and Amenhotep II, the Exodus pharaoh. But like I said, he didn't lose control over his empire, and when Amenhotep took over, the picture just shows a continuous, unbroken flow. Those who ignore these points treat the historical statements in Scripture with skepticism until they can be confirmed by archaeology. So we say, well, we can't believe that until I can prove it archaeologically. And we do that all the time. We want something else to confirm what God has said in His Word before we commit ourselves to that, before we commit ourselves to living in terms of that Word. And Egypt was devastated by the 10 plagues. On top of that, they lost their entire army and their king on the same day. And through the leaving of the Jews and the deaths from the plagues, it is possible that half the population of the nation was gone. Most of the cattle were gone, most of the seasoned crops, and a significant amount of wealth. And to assume that such economic and personal catastrophes as these would leave no evidence behind is impossible to believe. There's no recorded evidence, there's no nothing anywhere in the 18th dynasty to say that this could have possibly happened now. There's no kind of cover-up could have hidden the scars caused by such upheaval. So you cannot place the Exodus in the 18th dynasty. So as I've said, early on in the 12th dynasty, in the reign of Sesostris I, there is an inscription that reflects the biblical details about the famine in Egypt during Joseph's time. And then the timing from that inscription to the time of the Hyksos invasion of Egypt is the time frame we have from Joseph to the Exodus. So there's a match there in the Egyptian history as to the timing we have in the scriptures from Joseph to the Exodus. So there's a correlation to that. There are also records from the time of Sesostris I of a foreigner who became an important official in the kingdom. So there's inscriptions. So you're saying, okay, well, this is sounding like Joseph. It was Sesostris III that enslaved Israel, and Egyptian sources reveal that the form of government over Egypt before his reign was very spread out in the sense of it was decentralized. So there was a decentralized authority with lots of different princes. And Joseph, in fact, is called a prince in Genesis. And so there were different princes in power and ruling, although Joseph was probably a prince of Goshen, but also second in power to Pharaoh. But when Sesostris III came to power, he was very focused on absolute control and dominance. And the Egyptian sources tell us this, and so he just centralized everything and he took complete control. And you could understand it's possible at that point where this guy is saying, I could care less about anybody else, let alone foreigners who are in our land. And so dominated them and got them to build his empire. And they built this in the Delta region where there are massive remains which date from the 12th dynasty, which were built by the Jewish slaves under Sesostris. So you've got the same building taking place there as opposed to the 18th having Thebes where nothing was going on in the 18th dynasty. Amenhotep III succeeded Sesostris III, and it was his daughter who adopted Moses, and she ruled after her father. As I said, because there was no heir after Moses fled from Egypt, and she reigned only a short time, and then she died, and the 12th dynasty came to an end, and the 13th dynasty began. And it was in the reign of the second king of this dynasty that the Exodus occurred, and that king's tomb was never found. He was buried in the Red Sea. It was during the 13th dynasty that the Hyksos invaded Egypt. The historian priest Manetho from the 3rd century BC, who originally constructed these dynasties, wrote about the saying that they conquered the land, the Hyksos, without striking a blow. And then the historian Josephus picks up on that and he says the Hyksos took over Egypt without a battle. So from that side, so we've had the Exodus, and you say, okay, so the Egyptian chronology, we can find the Exodus at a certain point in the beginning of the 13th dynasty, and then you've got the Hyksos in power for a while after that, and a lowering of the civilization and what was going on in Egypt. Now, you wouldn't expect to find in Egyptian inscriptions anything that's going on in the Promised Land now, or the land of Canaan, as the Jews moved out, which is rightly so. So they knew to shift your attention, and scholarship did that as well. They said, okay, we kind of have realized we're in a bit of a mess with Egyptian chronology and Egyptian tying up with the biblical, so let's shift our focus across to Canaan and see if we can find any archaeological stuff to support and help and give us leads. So a lot of attention was focused upon archaeological digs in Canaan. And so one would expect that from 1450 is the Exodus, by 1400 BC, you would expect this to start to be signs of there being turmoil in Canaan, as the Jews now, after their wandering around in the wilderness, entered into the Promised Land to start to take possession. And so is there any evidence of that in there? So the conquest can be defined only in terms of the appearance of the expected evidence in Palestine as observed archaeologically. This expected evidence would include a widespread destruction of cities and also unmistakable evidence of a total change in culture, which continued in use with slight variations for 800 years. So that's what you're looking for. We're looking for this complete change, destruction of cities, and a change in culture that rebirthed upon these destroyed cities. And that this culture that replaced the old culture continued for an extended period of time, because the Jews inhabited that land. And so you've got your archaeologists that go and they start to dig through the different levels of dirt and stuff, and they, by what they find, they start to label things. So they, you know, they go through and they say, well, this is early Bronze One Age, early Bronze Second Age, early Bronze Third Age, and then you'll have your Middle Bronze First Age, Middle Bronze Second Age, and you'll go down to Late Bronze First Age, Late Bronze Second Age, Iron Age. And they're doing that by the stuff they're finding and the evidence that is coming up. Okay, so now you're not arguing with their classification. You're saying, fine, I'm sure you're finding different things and you're seeing a progression in a certain way, so you're labeling these things. Now, the problem comes when you start to put dates onto these. And so then I take their dates and they say, okay, so early Bronze Age 1 is dated from. And they assign a date to it. And then they just go down and each level is dated. And so when they find evidence now as to, on this dig, as Late Bronze Age 1, and they say what was taking place at Late Bronze Age 1, they evaluate that with the date next to it, so they know that's the date, then they tie that up with the Egyptian chronology, and then they look at the Bible and say, okay, so it couldn't be the Bible, because this date doesn't match anything that's there. And so your early Bronze Age starts in 3200 BC, and your Iron Age is like from 1200 BC to 900, so you've got this wide range of dates. So we, as biblical scholars, are looking for archaeological evidence in Palestine that will tie in with the biblical account of the conquest between 1400 and 1250 BC. That's what we're looking for, from after the Exodus, 1400 BC onwards. However, when using the classification that's established by your main archaeological scholars about the system, how they classify this, there's no evidence found at the expected levels. For example, they've got Late Bronze Age 1 and 2 levels, is they've got dated from the period we'd be looking at, 1500 to 1400 BC and 1400 to 1200 BC. So that's where they would classify, that's where they put the dates of the Exodus and the conquest. Late Bronze Age 1 and 2. So every time we get to that in the archaeological discoveries, we realize that there's no connection between what they're finding in those levels and what the scriptures have explained. And thus, there's no evidence to suggest that great destructions depicted in the Bible took place at that point. Now, the ultimate question that we must ask is, does such evidence exist at all? Is there any evidence that such destruction exists? And if there is, and then surely it's the ancient chronology that must be judged by the Bible and found to be in error. But what's happened is that this man-made absolute standard of these dates has been used to determine the accuracy of Scripture. When there's a discrepancy, the Bible is presumed to be wrong. archaeologists expected to find some evidence of the conquest at the end of the Late Bronze I or Bronze II, precisely because they believed that the Late Bronze Age corresponded to the time of Joshua. And we'll see that not only did they not find such evidence in the Late Bronze Age where they expected it, but they did not recognize the sought-for evidence when it turned up in an unexpected point, namely the Early Bronze Age. So it was way up, but Early Bronze, Middle Bronze, Late Bronze. They're looking for the evidence down here when it actually is appearing up there. So basically, the conquest of Canaan occurred in the Early Bronze III period. Catherine Kenyon, I'm going to be quoting from a number of archaeologists who are not Christians and they're not trying to support the biblical point. And this really does show that they're not being biased. And so what they're finding and what they're describing, you're saying, well, this is exactly what the Bible has said, but they're not seeing that connection. So they're not manipulating the evidence. They're just saying, this is what I'm discovering at this level. They think the Exodus was still 900 years away from this. So, you know, it really brings, I think, makes their testimony credible that you can say, well, they're not trying to manipulate and exaggerate what they're finding. So she says, and this is quoted in the Cambridge Ancient History, 3rd edition, volume 1, part 2, page 567. She says, at the end of the Early Bronze Age, there is a complete and absolute break in Palestinian civilization. Just when we're expecting Israel to move into the Promised Land, she's found evidence in her diggings that says there's an absolute break with the civilization of this period. Paul Lapp, the same background as her in the sense of he's not trying to push the Christian agenda. He said, attention may be directed first to the destruction of the fortified towns. All these flourishing towns appear to have been violently destroyed within a relatively short period of time in the Early Bronze III period. Kenyon writes, the final end of the Early Bronze Age civilization came with catastrophic completeness. The last of the Early Bronze Age walls of Jericho was built in a hurry using old and broken bricks and was probably not completed when it was destroyed by fire. All the finds show that there was an absolute break and that a new people took the place of the early inhabitants. Every town in Palestine that has so far been investigated shows the same break. It was in her book, Archaeology of the Holy Land. And many other archaeologists said the same thing. There was a similar widespread destruction at the end of the Late Bronze Age. But Miller, he's another archaeologist, said that the cities destroyed at this time do not correspond to the Bible's narrative of the conquest. Miller showed up the error of many who held that the conquest occurred in the Late Bronze Age by showing that excavations done at Jericho, Ai, and Gibeon and other cities show little, if any, late bronze remains. His conclusion was that there was little or no evidence that these cities had been occupied during the Late Bronze, much less been destroyed. They find nothing in the Late Bronze where most people put the Christian thing, and then they read back into that therefore the Bible, we have question marks about its authority. Jericho was the first city conquered by Israel after crossing the Jordan. And Joshua 6 tells us that the city walls fell flat and everything was burned with fire. Kenyon, again talking about Jericho, said, it was violently destroyed by fire and it was succeeded by an occupation of an entirely different character. And she says again in a different book, the layers of burning are found both on the inner and the outer side of the wall, and no doubt much of the town went up in flames at the same time. The destruction of the walls was the work of enemies. News of imminent danger caused the inhabitants to rebuild their defenses in headlong haste. Before their task was completed, they were overwhelmed. The disaster was indeed complete, for this was the end, Early Bronze Age Jericho. And Kenyon's excavations also reveal that almost total absence of evidence that Jericho was occupied during the Late Bronze Age, where most people put the Exodus and the crossing into the Promised Land. Now, Ai fell shortly after Jericho, and Tel, which is the excavation site, Et Tel, is the site commonly identified as Ai. And Kenyon said, the excavations showed, however, that the site was abandoned at the end of the Early Bronze Age and was not reoccupied until well into the Iron Age. At the end of the Early Bronze Age, the early history of the site came to an abrupt end. It was presumably destroyed by the invading nomads. So she said, well, there's some people came in here. We don't know who they were. They weren't the Israelites. And then this town wasn't inhabited again until the Iron Age, which is past the time where supposedly the children of Israel came into the promised land in the late Bronze Age, and therefore the whole story about Ai is a fabrication because it doesn't square up with historical and archaeological evidence. So the Bible again is found to be at fault. Jack Finnegan said, this city was completely destroyed and abandoned about 220 BC, that's traditional dates, and the site was not occupied again except by a brief village settlement somewhere between 1200 and 1000. So clearly showing that what we have in the scriptures is unreliable. Ai had presented a serious problem for those who placed the conquest at the end of Late Bronze I and Late Bronze II. As Joseph Calloway said, its earliest occupation evidence after the early Bronze Age destruction of the site is Iron Age I. There is no evidence of a late bronze occupation. So once again, another archaeologist confirming that the conquest of Ai didn't happen with Joshua. Another writer, G. Wright, says, at the time of the Israelite conquest, therefore, no city existed at this place. And so now we've got archaeological proof for that. And biblical scholars are impacted by that. And so they start to panic. They start to doubt the scriptures, the authenticity of God's word. And they start to make adjustments and modifications. After Ai, Joshua 8 tells us of the ceremony at Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim, the site of the ancient city of Shechem. This was the site where Shechem was. Shechem's going back to Jacob's day. Shechem was the place where his sons murdered that whole town. No mention is made of Shechem in chapter 8 of Joshua, but it is clear from later references in Joshua, in a number of places, that this geographic location of Shechem was known to the Israelites. The scriptures do not give any indication of the extent of the occupation at Shechem. All we know is that there is no report of any military action at Shechem at the time of the conquest. They didn't fight that city. They went from Jericho to Ai and then on to Gibeon or in Joshua 9. But they went to Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal, where Shechem right is, and there's no battle. Excavations have revealed at most a small settlement during the early Bronze Age, when Israel, we believe, was there. If we are correct in placing the conquest here, then we see why there is no conflict at Shechem. It was, in all likelihood, only a small, unfortified village, unable to resist the invaders. So as G. Wright said, by about 2300 BC, that's the traditional dating, a dark age had descended upon the country following the destruction of every major city-state center. As far as these have been investigated, they saw every single one has been destroyed. Shechem, judging from archaeological evidence, shared in these events only in a minor way, the first important period in the city's life being during the 19th century. Shechem was a significant walled city during the Middle Bronze II. Okay, now Middle Bronze II is the normal time where the so-called conquest took place, which we know is wrong. It was now a major city by that time. And yet Joshua leaves it alone in the story because it wasn't a major city when Israel truly went into that land. So it was again an important city in Late Bronze Age and Early Iron Age I. And so we see that once again, the archaeological evidence supports the account of Joshua. It supports what actually happened and what was on the ground when he moved into the promised land. Joshua 9 tells of the covenant between Israel and Gibeon. And if the conquest did occur at the end of early bronze, we should expect to find no evidence of destruction then, but rather a new cultural influence at the beginning of middle bronze. And this is exactly the case. James Pritchard has said, these relics of the Middle Bronze I people seem to indicate a fresh migration into the town of a nomadic people who brought with them an entirely new tradition in pottery forms and new customs in burial practices. So remember, the Gibeonites came out and lied from where they were from, and Joshua made a covenant with them, and then the covenant was, we will not destroy you. And so their city, which was just down the road, wasn't destroyed, but they say there was this complete change in culture, influenced by the Jews. They became the slaves, remember, of Joshua, so they weren't the dominant ones, and the Jews' culture dominated them at that time. So if the conquest occurred at the end of the Late Bronze, we have every reason to expect the excavations to uncover a Late Bronze city, especially in view of the fact of Joshua 10:2. One would expect to find city walls and houses if the tradition preserved in the book of Joshua is historically trustworthy. Yet later traces of the city of the later part of the Late Bronze period have not come to light. In four seasons of excavation, that's a guy called Pritchard who was writing and saying we didn't find that what we were expecting to find. But what we're seeing is that there's no evidence in the archaeology of Palestine that reveals a complete cultural break other than during the early Bronze Age. That's the only time. There's no other massive break with culture. But there does appear early on in the categorized areas. Such a break is necessary in light of the biblical account of the comprehensive destruction brought on the land. During the Middle Bronze Age, there was a series of destructions, but after each, the same culture reappeared. So there you've got different battles taking place, but the same person rebuilding. Miss Kenyon noted that the culture that was introduced into Palestine at the end of the early Bronze Age was to have a very long life. This culture occupied the same territory as that held by the Israelites and also continued for the expected time period. The identification of this new culture as being that of the Israelites is confirmed by the fact that at no time other than during the Israelite occupation was this territory occupied by a single culture. So you've got all these multitudes of cultures, multitudes of cities being devastated at the certain period and then inhabited and continued the same culture that inhabits this whole area for an extended period of time. And they say, no, this is not the same account that we find in Joshua. This is a different account. We don't find what Joshua says, we don't find anywhere, except all the evidence is lined up step after step, and there's nothing like a blind heart. Those who have plotted the conquest in the wrong archaeological age have looked for, but have not found, this complete cultural break. This has led some to propose that the invading Hebrews had no culture of their own, because they invaded at a different point. And because we don't find a whole culture break, they say, well, they didn't bring anything with them. Or it was just such a small amount of people. I mean, they've tried to reduce the numbers down. They've tried to do all kinds of stuff in order to sidestep the facts. Biblical scholars have struggled with the problem of reconciling the scriptural account of the conquest with the results of archaeological excavations. Although almost all agree that the conquest must have occurred at the end of the late Bronze Age, the diggings have revealed no evidence of a cultural break indicating the arrival of a new people at that point. The presuppositions of holding to the late Bronze Age conquest are that the conventional dating of the Egyptian dynasties and the archaeological ages provides an adequate framework for piecing together the history of ancient times. We hold on to Egypt's chronology and the dates we've assigned. We hold on to the archaeology of the Promised Land, Palestine, and we hold on to those dates. We refuse to shift. They are adequate. They are sufficient. And whatever doesn't fit in with them is erroneous. That's the presupposition. That's what they're going on, and that's what they're laying out. This underlying presupposition is not questioned. And then you had guys, Donovan Corvell with his books, and Emmanuel Velikovsky, who started writing, and they changed. Their presupposition was, we believe the Bible is correct. And we can now see if we can find the evidence that the Bible tells us about in these two areas. And they go into those areas and they say, yes, indeed, we find this evidence. The evidence given that we've looked at demonstrates conclusively that there is only one point in the sequence of archaeological periods that could possibly correspond to the Israelite conquest of Canaan. If the scriptural account of the conquest is true and accurate, then the sheer bulk of evidence, together with its uniqueness, forces us to conclude that the conquest must have occurred at the end of early Bronze III and could not have occurred at any other point. The people who conquered Palestine at the end of early Bronze III were none other than the Israelites. And if we follow biblical chronology, we can further conclude that the absolute date for the end of early Bronze III should be 1400 BC rather than 2300 BC. Recognizing the existence of such an enormous error in the dating of the archaeological periods in Palestine should make us realize the critical necessity of pursuing a systematic and comprehensive rewriting of ancient times, recognizing that the historical and chronological data of Scripture is of the highest quality. We mustn't doubt that. People often try and get us to fudge and say, okay, well, the historical stuff is kind of unreliable, give you the spiritual stuff. But once they take away an aspect and we concede that point, we're undermining our foundations. We need to stand upon that. And even if we can't reconcile everything because the archaeology hasn't yet been discovered, if we think about some of the cities that were only found in kind of modern times that the scriptures talk about and were unknown of until the 1800s, where we thought, well, they didn't exist. This was a fabricated city. We think of where Jonah went, Nineveh, cities like that that only came onto the scene at later periods. So It does help us to be encouraged. It is good to know about works out there that do that, because most Bible dictionaries you read, I have looked at a number of ones that I have access to and have had access to, and they're giving you 18th dynasty, 19th dynasty, or it doesn't really doesn't matter, because it's a spiritual thing. It's kind of speaking figuratively. And you go away from that and you're thinking, have we got vague stuff here? Is this just numbers? If you wanted some resources, there's two journals of Christian Reconstruction. The one is Volume 2, Number 1, that has a good article in there, which is Donovan Corvell's article. He's the guy who wrote the two volumes called The Exodus Problem and Its Ramifications. That's hard reading. Just that, you know, he's a very bright man, and sometimes the way they write down, it's hard to follow. So that if you want to get a synopsis of Donovan Corvell's thinking, that journal is good. And there's another journal of Christian Reconstruction, which is Volume 7, Number 1, Issue 1. It's a guy called Stan Veninger, and it's Archaeology and the Conquest of Canaan. And then you've got Emmanuel Velikovsky, who wrote a series which he titled Ages in Chaos. And then he's got a number of books in there, although unfortunately the first volume became known as Ages in Chaos. And that's kind of the title everybody knows. But there are a number of them that deal with Egyptian chronology that is good. But once again, it's also tough reading, but it's worth the effort. If there are any questions or comments.
I have one question, maybe, and maybe it's just speculative because I don't know if we know the answer, but when I think about, this is the same kind of a presuppositional commitment that you see in evolution. They'll go out and do their archaeological digs and they'll say, oh, we know that here is this layer and this layer is X million years old or 100 million years old because of the rocks that we found in it. And then they'll go somewhere else and they'll dig and they'll find the rocks and they'll say, oh, we know these are X hundred million years old because we found them in this layer. So you get the circular reasoning. We date the rocks by the layer. We date the layer by the rocks. How do you know any of it's right? You don't. But in that scenario, we understand what motivates them, because they have to have hundreds of millions of years for evolution. We get that. All this stuff is taking place within 1,000 years. Why the commitment to the Egyptian chronology if the biblical data would be useful to them even in a secular way? Why not just work it out within that 1,000 years?
My guess at that would be just the sinfulness of the heart, where there's the continued suppression of the truth. Because as soon as you start to admit that indeed this is a true, accurate account, historical account that dates back for all this time, I've now got to deal with the God who was behind that. And the situations where we're seeing this revelation, and then we're proving that indeed this is exactly what took place, you're confronted. Just as the evolutionist originally was confronted with the fact, it's either God or we find something else. And so they found something else. And I'm open to people to contribute and add to that. But I think it's a manifestation of the suppression of the truth in the heart. Let's spend some time in prayer.